Today is Tuesday, the 9th of December, and you are listening to the World Socialist website. The Bondi Memorandum. FBI, DOJ seek to outlaw political opposition. Patrick Martin, December the 8th, 2025. A memorandum from US Attorney General Pam Bondi, issued December the 4th, instructs all federal prosecutors and law enforcement agencies to compile lists of organizations to be slandered and criminalized as, quote, domestic terrorists because they oppose fascism and capitalism and advocate for socialism. The six-page document uncovered and made public by journalist Ken Klippenstein is a blueprint for federal officials on how to implement National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, NSPN 7, issued by Trump on September the 25th, after the assassination of ultra-right activist Charlie Kirk, a close associate of the fascist cabal in the White House. NSPM 7 is so broadly worded that, as the WSWS warned at the time, it would criminalize virtually all political opposition to the Trump administration, even including the Democratic Party, which holds 47 out of 100 seats in the U.S. Senate and 213 out of 435 seats in the House of Representatives. Its language is reproduced in the Bondi Memorandum, which describes, quote, domestic terrorists as advocating, quote, opposition to law and immigration enforcement, extreme views in favour of mass migration and open borders, adherence to radical gender ideology, anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism or anti-Christianity, and, quote, hostility towards traditional views on family, religion and morality, end of quote. It is likely that the majority of the American people and vast majority of young people hold such oppositional views, given the deep alienation produced by decades of declining living standards, endless imperialist wars, the deliberate promotion of religious backwardness and anti-scientific nostrums, and the transformation of the Republican Party into an openly fascist organization. The rising support for socialism is expressed both in opinion polls, again particularly among young people, and the electoral success of figures like New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mandani, who campaigned under the socialist label while advocating minor liberal reforms, which he's already abandoning. While Mandani grovelled before Trump at the White House, the Trump administration is targeting Mandani's supporters and perhaps Mandani himself for violent repression. A major factor underlying the actions of the Trump administration is preparations for elections in 2026. In addition to the Bondi memo, Trump officials have repeatedly threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act, giving the president the authority to deploy the military domestically. This would allow for any elections, if held at all, to proceed under conditions of effective martial law. The latest document from Bondi spells out a series of steps by federal officials and agencies to fulfill Trump's demand for a sweeping crackdown on political opposition. Within 14 days of the issuance of the Bondi Memorandum, December 18, 2025, all federal law enforcement agencies are to deliver to the FBI all files, quote, for Antifa and Antifa-related intelligence and information, end of quote. Given that Antifa is not an actual organization, but rather a label applied to anyone engaged in anti-fascist political activity of any kind, this means the centralization into the hands of the FBI of all information on virtually all left-wing political groups. Within 30 days, January the 3rd, 2026, the FBI is to compile a master list of, quote, groups or entities engaged in acts that may constitute domestic terrorism, provide it to the Deputy Attorney General, and issue an initial report on the development of strategies to disrupt and dismantle entire networks of criminal activity, end of quote, i.e. the suppression of political opposition. Also within 30 days, the FBI is to upgrade its telephone and social media tip lines for domestic terror threats, quote, so that witnesses and citizen journalists can send media of suspected acts of domestic terrorism to law enforcement online, end of quote. The aim, as demonstrated in Portland and other cities, is to use fascist vigilantes as spotters to direct violent police attacks against left-wing protests. Within 60 days, the FBI and its partner agencies, quote, shall disseminate an intelligence bulletin on Antifa and Antifa-aligned anarchist violent extremist groups. The bulletin should describe the relevant organization's structures, funding, sources, and tactics, end of quote. The aim here is to frame up organizers of peaceful protests at which supposed Antifa or police provocateurs engage in violence. In addition, in order to recruit paid informants to spy on and infiltrate left-wing organizations, the FBI, quote, shall establish a cash reward system for information that leads to successful identification and arrest of individuals in the leadership of domestic terrorist organizations that conspire with others to commit violations of provisions of law or other offenses against the United States. Quote, as investigations continue and potential prosecutions begin, the memorandum continues, the FBI, quote, shall aim to establish cooperators to provide information and eventually testify against other members of the leadership of the targeted organizations. In other words, informants will become stool pigeons and state witnesses in show trials of the supposed, quote, domestic terrorists. The Bondi Memorandum lists no less than 25 separate legal provisions that could potentially be used against targeted groups. This lumps together such crimes as murder for hire and planting explosives with non-violent civil disobedience tactics, described as, quote, resisting or impeding federal officers and picketing or parading with intent to obstruct the administration of justice, end of quote. Virtually any political act of protest against Trump's immigration Gestapo would be criminalized on this basis. Whenever Trump and his fascist cohort speak of, quote, domestic terrorism, they are not referring to actual advocates of violence but to left-wing political opposition, particularly that developing from the working class. Trump's real attitude towards political violence was shown in his action on the first day he re-entered the White House when he pardoned all of the fascist thugs who stormed the US Capitol on January 6, 2021, and temporarily halted the congressional certification of Trump's defeat in the 2020 presidential election. It is a measure of their utter cynicism and contempt for public opinion that Trump and Bondi propose to use the same laws under which the January 6 rioters were indicted and convicted to target those who oppose the administration's persecution of immigrants and its preparations for presidential dictatorship. While they denounce, quote, anti-fascism, claiming it is a smear tactic and a pretext for violence, the same administration has just issued a national security strategy document that openly aligns US foreign policy with fascist parties in Europe, like the Alternative for Germany, the AFD, and the French National Rally, RN, and effectively embraces the neo-Nazi, quote, great replacement theory that whites are being deliberately replaced by non-whites in a conspiracy orchestrated by wealthy Jews. In the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, the Socialist Equality Party issued a statement summing up the dangers posed to democratic rights and warning working people and young people. We declared, quote, it is necessary to put aside all self-deluding hopes that what is unfolding is anything less than a drive to establish a presidential dictatorship based on the military, police, paramilitary forces and fascist thugs, end of quote. In the 80 days which have passed, the danger has not lessened. On the contrary, the Trump administration has begun to systematize its attacks on democratic rights, beginning with the persecution of immigrant workers, but directed ultimately against the entire working class. This is a government of the oligarchy, waging an all-out war on the working class. It is carrying out the destruction of vital social programs that millions depend on, slashing public education, privatizing health care, gutting retirement and disability benefits, and dismantling what remains of the social safety net. Nothing that detracts from the accumulation of wealth by the corporate and financial elite is to be spared. The decisive question remains one of political organization and leadership. The Democratic Party will not fight Trump's drive towards dictatorship because, like him, it is a party of the financial aristocracy, committed above all to the defense of the super-rich and the capitalist state machine. The response of the Democratic Party to the Bondi memo has been one of silence. Leading Democrats have not only failed to denounce this fascistic declaration of war against political opposition, They have made clear through their actions that they will do nothing to stop Trump's drive towards dictatorship. Their response to the massed opposition expressed in the October No Kings demonstrations was to end the government shutdown on Trump's terms and bail out the administration. When it comes to the assault on left-wing opponents of inequality, war and dictatorship, the Democrats, a party of Wall Street and American imperialism, are co-conspirators. The Bondi memo must be understood as part of an ongoing and escalating conspiracy. The Trump administration, in crisis and facing growing opposition, is not retreating. It is doubling down. The working class must respond with its own offensive. It must intervene independently by building new forms of organisation, rank-and-file committees in workplaces, schools and neighbourhoods that unify workers across industries and national boundaries. These committees, coordinated through the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, the IWA-RFC, must become centres of resistance to Trump's dictatorship and the entire capitalist system. The right to defend democratic rights is inseparable from the right for socialism. The turn towards dictatorship is the political expression of the rule of the capitalist oligarchy. The defence of the most basic democratic rights requires the mobilisation of the working class to expropriate the oligarchy, abolish capitalism and reorganise society on the basis of social need, not private profit. Quote, "Our family wants answers that we have not gotten," end of quote. 8 months since the death of Stellantis worker Ronald Adams Sr. Jerry White, December 8, 2025. December 7 marked 8 months since the death of 63-year-old machine repairman Ronald Adams Sr. at the Stellantis Dundee Engine Complex in Michigan. His death on the shop floor, crushed while performing maintenance on a gantry hoist that suddenly activated, continues to be shrouded in silence. The Michigan Occupational Safety and Health Administration, MIOSHA, MIOSHA, has still not issued the results of its probe into the April 7 fatality, with MIOSHA spokesman Mike Kravchik informing the WSWS by email Monday that, quote, "the investigation remains open." He did not provide any explanation for the long delay, stating only that, quote, "Fatality investigations can take significant time due to their complexity, including the availability of witness interviews, technical and engineering review, records examination, and required legal due process." End of quote. Far from holding the company accountable, the United Auto Workers Union has been complicit in suppressing the facts. UAW President Sean Fain and UAW Stellantis Department Head Kevin Godinsky assisted management in bringing the plant back to full production, and Stellantis is churning out engines for new Stellantis models as if nothing happened. The cold bureaucratic choreography, management's cover-up, the union's whitewash, and the state agency's delays is the logic of a system that treats workers' lives as expendable. Quote, "The holidays are especially difficult for our family," Ronald's widow, Shemenia Stewart Adams, told the WSWS. Quote, "We miss him in a way that is beyond words. We had no time to prepare. There was no illness. One day he was just gone," end of quote. Addressing the silence of company, UAW and state safety officials, she said, quote, "We have not gotten any answers from OSHA and the closure we need. Our family wants answers. We want answers that we haven't gotten, and that's really, really unsettling," end of quote. On July the 27th, the International Workers' Alliance of Rank-and-File Committees, the IWA-RFC, held a public hearing in Detroit where it presented the initial findings of its independent investigation into the death of Ronald Adams Sr. During the hearing, Adams' widow made an impassioned appeal for his co-workers to come forward and provide information to uncover the truth and hold accountable all those responsible. Now Shemenia has spoken out in support of the families and co-workers of two United States Postal Service USPS workers who were killed in the space of a week last month. On November the 8th, 36-year-old maintenance mechanic Nick Acker was crushed to death by a mail sorting machine at the Detroit Network Distribution Center in Allen Park, Michigan. 1 week later, on November the 15th, mail handler assistant Russell Scruggs, Jr., 44, fell and hit his head at a mail processing center in Palmetto, Georgia. Shamania said, "Find the strength and don't stop fighting for workers to be treated not just as an employee ID number, but a human being who was just trying to make a living for their family. These are not just numbers being sacrificed, but are our loved ones, our husbands, fathers, brothers, uncles and grandfathers who deserve to be valued. A lot of these companies have the mindset their workers are just numbers who have no value. That's where we are now. My husband went to work, he did his job, he did it well. He saved lives on that job multiple times, and I feel like his life was devalued, and that hurts. In a nutshell, our family just wants answers." End of quote. Following the lead of the Ronald Adams investigation, the Postal Workers Rank and File Committee, the PWRFC, issued an open letter calling on postal workers to come forward with information as part of an independent worker-led inquiry into the deaths of the two workers. Postal workers have reported that grievances over safety violations, including complaints about the very mail-sorting machine that killed Acker, were filed with the American Postal Workers Union, the APWU, and ignored. They also said that safety features had been disabled, maintenance staffing was inadequate, and management kept machines idling rather than shutting them down for proper repairs. As for Russell Scruggs Jr., workers said there were significant delays in potentially life-saving medical treatment due to the lack of cell phone service and emergency protocols. This corporate indifference and union collusion has created deadly conditions at the Stellantis Toledo assembly complex, just north of the Dundee engine plant, where there has been a spike in injuries due to exhausting work schedules imposed with the blessing of the UAW bureaucracy. Citing lost production due to supply chain interruptions, management has kept the factory on, quote, emergency status for months. Workers are on shifts lasting between 9 and 12 hours, 6 to 7 days a week, with many not seeing a day off for more than 3 weeks. According to an internal safety memo posted inside the plant, the factory accounted for 30% of the injuries at all 75 Stellantis factories and parts distribution centres in North America since September the 1st. 8 months before Adams' death, Antonio Gaston, a 53-year-old father of four, was crushed to death at the Toledo factory. Attorneys who are filing a wrongful death lawsuit on behalf of Gaston's family alleged that although he was a material handler, Gaston was put on the assembly line because of manpower shortages due to a previous mass layoff. In addition, they say that safety guards may have been removed on the machine that killed him to prevent any delays in production. OSHA cited the company for the lack of safety guards, but only fined the company $16,000 for the safety violation that led to Gaston's death. Stellantis has challenged the fine. Although Stellantis' own internal records show a spike in injuries, the Toledo Blade reported that, quote, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration has not recorded any accidents at the Jeep plant since August 21, 2024, when Antonio Gaston was killed while working on the Gladiator line. This is despite the fact, as the Blade notes, that, quote, OSHA requires employers to report work-related fatalities within 8 hours and accidents that lead to inpatient hospitalizations, amputations or loss of an eye within 24 hours, end of quote. To avoid reporting, quote, lost time injuries and paying workers compensation, employers routinely force injured workers back to work when they are assigned menial chores. A former Dundee worker described this inhuman practice during his testimony at the July 27 IWA RFC hearing. Additional evidence was presented during the hearing showing how management routinely cut corners on safety to finish retooling the plant, whose reopening was more than a year behind schedule. This included pressure to hurry repairs and bypass lockout-tagout procedures, the basic safeguards that stop machines being energized when they are being repaired or maintained. After Adam's death, workers reported being assembled in an auditorium and ordered not to speak publicly. Emails were sent telling employees to, quote, return cheater keys used to defeat lockout-tagout systems. Those who tried to speak to Adam's family or expose conditions were threatened with dismissal, and one former worker says he was verbally menaced after speaking out. Far from the authorities carrying out a thorough investigation, the contractors who programmed the Synetic washer and the very overhead gantry that killed Adams were never interviewed by OSHA, the company, and the UAW. In his report to the public hearing, Will Lehman, a leader of the IWA RFC, called Adams a, quote, martyr in the class war against the working class, explaining that at least 15 workers are killed on the job every day in the US, or roughly 450 workers each month, or over 5,200 every year. Globally, nearly 3 million workers lost their lives from workplace injuries and occupational diseases, an average of 8,000 deaths each day. Lehman pointed to the broader political context, pointing to the Trump administration's drive to gut whatever is left of OSHA and lift any restrictions on the exploitation of the working class and further enrich the oligarchy of mega-billionaires. Workers cannot look to the Democrats or the union bureaucracies to defend their lives, Lehman said, but had to build rank-and-file committees in every workplace to, quote, fight for the principle that no job should be carried out unless and until it is made safe. In consultation with trusted safety experts of our own choosing, workers must have full authority to set safety standards and shut down unsafe operations through collective action, end of quote. Lehman concluded, our goal is to place control over workplace safety into the hands of the working class itself as part of the broader struggle for workers' control over production. As long as production is driven by profit and controlled by corporate owners, workers' lives will remain expendable. Ronald Adams' tragic death must not be in vain. He symbolizes a global crisis, representing all workers who have lost their lives, suffered injuries, or endured exploitation and abuse under capitalism. This hearing will review what we have uncovered so far, but this is just the beginning of a movement, an international movement to end industrial slaughter once and for all. We call on everyone here to join us in that fight. Jenny will now read our tribute to Comrade Ken Mantell.
Thanks, Carol. Ken Mantell, Australian Trotskyist, November 11, 1945 to November 30, 2025, by Cheryl Crisp. It is with great sorrow that we report that long-standing Socialist Equality Party member Comrade Ken Mantell died on November 30, 2 days after suffering a massive stroke. He was 80 years old and is survived by his 3 sons, Stephen, Matthew and Jason, 6 grandchildren and 6 siblings. Ken, the 3rd son in a family of 6 boys and 2 girls, was born on November 11, 1945 in Melbourne to parents Jeff and Mary. The family of 10, living in the shadow of World War II, survived on the wage of their father Jeff, a toolmaker, and the sporadic income Mary could earn before the children were born. Rationing was still in place, and the Mantell family would have been using ration books, queuing for certain foods and making do with limited supplies, especially of meat, butter, sugar and tea. There was little surplus and even less waste in the household. Constant budgeting, repairing, reusing and going without luxuries was standard. Ken, along with his siblings, was educated in the Catholic school system, where he attracted the ire of the Christian Brothers from an early age until he finished Year 8 and left. During his primary school years, he began to play a vital role for the family by earning money, which he gave straight to his mother. Before and after school, he sold papers on the street, gathered firewood for the combustion stove, and collected soft drink and beer bottles for trade-ins to help cover household expenses. He left school at 14 to begin his working life, taking on roles such as a storeman, crockery salesman, truck driver, labourer, and steel fixer. It was in the building industry as a steel fixer that Ken spent many decades, teaching himself to read architectural drawings and studying the different types of steel used. In his later years, he also worked in the printing industry, learning a trade for which he had no prior experience. Ken worked in some of the most diverse, remote and demanding parts of Australia. While spending years on building sites and factories in the country's major cities, he also worked in the scorching heat and dust of Condobolin in New South Wales, Western Australia, and the central Queensland towns of Moura, Mount Isa, and nearby Lake Julius, created by the dam he helped build. Although Ken left school early, he was utterly determined to overcome his lack of education. Ken's older brother, Martin, with whom he maintained the closest relationship until his death, would send him the Time magazine each week for Ken to read to improve his skills. He read each issue diligently. It was as a steel fixer that he joined the Socialist Labour League, SLL, the precursor to the Socialist Equality Party, after being introduced to the party by his then-wife Liz in the early 1980s, and was won over to the program of socialist internationalism. During the CQEB dispute, when in 1985 the hated right-wing Bjelke-Petersen government in Queensland sacked more than 1,000 electricity workers, he and Liz, with a young Jason in a stroller, campaigned at the mass meeting selling Workers' News, the weekly publication of the SLL. Once Ken was convinced of the program and the need to build the Revolutionary Party, he never wavered and kept studying. Even when he struggled with harsh medication to manage his health issues, he insisted on attending the weekly educations run by the SEP. He dedicated his considerable talents, effort and determination to the creation of the Revolutionary Party for mankind's liberation through a socialist future. He was not just a hard man, as they say, but was politically intransigent in opposing and exposing the betrayals and perfidy of the trade union bureaucracy, in particular the Stalinists of the Communist Party of Australia and the Maoists, including Norm Gallagher, leader of the Builders Labourers Federation, BLF. During the attack on the BLF by the federal Hawke-Keating Labour government in 1986, Ken, as a member of the SLL, fought against the deregistration of the union while exposing Gallagher's role. The BLF leader's attempt to channel opposition and anger into the courts was driven more by his fear of an independent workers' movement than by the attacks from the Labour government. While these and many other struggles were important, he rightly identified the key fight of his political life as being against the National Opportunists of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, WRP, in Britain. Having been a party member for a relatively short period, Ken stood with the International Committee of the Fourth International in opposing the WRP's subordination of the working class to the British Labour Party, trade union bureaucracy, and bourgeois nationalist regimes in the Middle East and beyond. Ken understood that the political struggle waged during the 1985-86 split with the WRP leadership would determine not only the future direction of the ICFI, but also its very existence. The adaptation of the WRP leadership of Healy, Banda and Slaughter to nationalism in the form of Stalinism, social democracy, and the positions of Pavloite opportunism would have led to the liquidation of the party into those forces, the very political formations that all three WRP renegades joined after abandoning the Trotskyist movement. Ken stood as a candidate for the SLL-SEP in both federal and state elections, led branches, and worked in most areas of the party, including as a full-time cadre of the SEP. In 2024, Ken spoke alongside Comrade Warwick Dove at an SEP public meeting called to warn of attacks by the Labor government on the Construction, Forestry and Maritime Employees Union, CFMEU, outlining some of his key experiences in fighting for the party's perspective among building workers in the 1980s. Ken recounted that in 1989, as a BLF delegate, he went to the podium of a mass meeting of 5,000 building workers. The union bureaucracy attempted to stop him by taking the microphone from him, but the workers refused to allow it and demanded he be permitted to speak. Ken presented a motion opposing the attack on the BLF and calling for a struggle that would not only involve building workers, but also extend throughout the working class. The motion was carried at the meeting. The young students and workers in the audience were captivated by his contribution, which he found greatly satisfying. The recent period has been especially tough for Ken. His long-term partner, Comrade Regina Law, developed breast cancer, and although she and Ken fought it as best they could, passed away from the disease in October 2022, just over 3 years ago. Ken's own health was profoundly affected by the grueling conditions in which he worked as a steel fixer in the building industry. He suffered multiple ailments that he also fought to keep at bay. His death followed an attempt to overcome tremors caused by damage to his arms and shoulders from carrying heavy loads of steel year after year. Ken, however, did not seek to overcome his ailments so he could smell the roses or wander peacefully in the garden, but rather so he could more effectively fight for the working class and promote a socialist perspective. He was a party member deeply concerned with workers and young people, their lives, their experiences, and their misconceptions, which he laboured to combat and clarify. He always made a point of seeking out young members to discuss and guide them in their training and development. He was generous to a fault with his time and resources. He understood that if the working class did not consciously embrace a revolutionary perspective, capitalism would impose the worst nightmare on the new and emerging generations of young people. He saw in his sons and grandchildren representatives of that generation and felt deeply about the risks they face. He loved them dearly and dedicated his life to overcoming the obstacles to a socialist future, which is the only way to ensure mankind's future. We send our deepest condolences to the family, comrades and friends of Comrade Ken Mantell. Future generations will look to him as a shining example to be emulated by workers and young people everywhere. For these articles and more, visit the World Socialist website, wsws.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Carol Diviak and Jenny Campbell.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.